Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, a weekly podcast that gives thoughtful people some perspective and insight on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 10th, 2014. Tonight, we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific social media analyst, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
That's good. Good. So, this is now almost tax season. By the time we speak again, we'll have paid our taxes, and life will march forward. But speaking of things that are nearly inevitable, like death and taxes, there was a funny number that came across the wires this week about the parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, right? Can you see anything there?
Yes, that's correct. There was a report earlier this week from the website Mashable.com noting that the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere has now hit 402 parts per million during the most recent couple of days of observations. It's sort of hanging up there, which is higher than at any time in at least the past 800,000 years, which is obviously not good because the higher the CO2 levels are, the more danger we're in as a planet, and the more we need to have, since you mentioned the tax season, the more we need to have some carbon taxes to sort of ramp those emissions down.
That's square in the circle. Well, for those people who've listened to this podcast, we did speak about this milestone last year, almost this time, I think it was May of last year, where the parts per million level had crossed the 400 ppm mark. Now, let's just recap. What we're talking about is a measurement that's in the units of parts per million, which is basically taking the volume and chopping it up into a million pieces. And of those now, 400 would be assigned to carbon dioxide if you did that to the atmosphere. This time last year, for the first time, we began to cross that 400 ppm level. And if you've ever seen what's called the Keeling curve, you've seen the Keeling curve, right, DR?
Yes.
It's a rising line over the years, but it's got kind of a wiggle on top of it that represents the different seasons. And so this time last year, we were kind of at the peak, and we were crossing over the 400 ppm level every couple of days. But now, as you said, so the average is up around 402, and we're basically above the 400 parts per million all the time, every day. And it's not going back anytime soon, right?
Exactly. And as Mashable pointed out, Andrew Friedman was the writer for Mashable. Even though we did hit 400 parts per million for the first time in May of 2013, this year the threshold of 400 parts per million has been crossed even earlier, which means, according to Friedman, it is more likely that the annual peak, which typically occurs in mid to late May, will climb further above 400 parts per million for the first time. So, in other words, the higher the CO2 level goes, the deeper the threat level goes. So it's not a very good sign at all.
Yeah, the 400 parts per million level is, as they say, I saw a report that said it was somewhere between, it has not been this high since some interval between 15 million years ago and 800,000. It's essentially a million years ago. So it could have been an incredibly long time we've had this much CO2. And what's also doubly alarming is that this CO2 rise is almost like a straight up rise. Whereas, in the past, 800,000 years ago, we might have been at 400 parts per million, but it took us 10,000 years to get there as it slowly rose. And here we've done essentially the same thing in 200 years. And that's what the threat is. I think oftentimes people forget that part of the threat of climate change is that we are changing the CO2 so quickly, it's probably never been this way in the history of the planet. I mean, you can have a higher level, but the rate at which we're changing it is so astronomically faster than the sort of the geological methods. There's a real threat there. Yeah, and of course, last week we talked about the list of biblical plagues that would be visited upon us that were listed in the IPCC report about all of the things that are coming in. So you heard it here. 400 parts per million, and it's going to keep going up. We'll put up a link to the these various pictures. You said it's on Mashable, right?
Mashable.com, that's correct.
Yeah. So there's that. And while that carbon dioxide was slowly rising above the, above the 400 ppm level, most of us were watching TV, right? So, so there was an interesting show that I saw that came on Sunday night. I think it was on NBC, and it was hosted by a woman named Ann Curry. And the name of that show was...
it was called Our Year of Extremes, Did Climate Change Just Hit Home?
Did Climate Change Just Hit Home? And so what I saw her do was basically go and interview people in different parts of the world, different parts of the country, to find out what the impact of climate change had been on them, right?
That's correct.
Did you see it?
Oh, yes,
what was your take on it, DR?
It fell just short of greatness. It was great to see a scientist such as Jason Box and climate scientist Jennifer Francis. Well, Jason Box is also a climate scientist, I should say, being interviewed and getting the exposure on you know, primetime network television. I was dismayed by the decision to include a very controversial fellow by the name of Roger Pilkey Jr., who is perhaps most famous for, you know, bashing anybody who's concerned about the issue and sort of, you know, wrapping himself in this cloak of self-righteousness. But even he, towards the end, you know, talked about the need to sort of take action and the things that can be done to sort of reduce emissions. So,
Tommy DR, before we leave the question of Roger Pilkey, I'm interested in him. He is a – Roger Pilkey is a scientist. I think he's from Colorado, right?
That's correct. He's a political scientist, but not a climate scientist.
Oh, guys. Really? He's a political scientist. Well, he seems as if sometimes he says things that are reasonable, and then other times he undermines all that credibility by saying things that are outrageous, right? And that's his MO. Is that sort of a way to get on TV, or do you know what the sort of the internal consistency of his approach is?
His shtick is very similar to that of Danish political scientist and non-climate scientist Bjørn Lomborg, who's also another notorious figure. Their shtick is to basically argue that yes, it's real, yes, it's human caused, but people who are really, really concerned about the issue are somehow wrong and alarmist and over the top and melodramatic, and basically he seems to blame climate activists more than climate deniers for our inability to resolve this problem politically.
So anyway, this is Roger Pilkey, who's on the Ann Curry TV show, the Ann Curry Report. And so do you think that he deserved to be there?
Obviously I don't. It just appeared to me that this is obviously pure speculation, but you can't help wondering if there was a sort of a management nudge to include a voice of contrarianism on the segment. The old Maxwell Boykoff argument about balance is bias, where you present two sides, one side that says we need to take action and another side that says, we kind of need to take action, but it's not really that big of a deal. And you do have to wonder, what was added into this segment? What was added into the show? What was taken out? I found it very interesting that there was no mention whatsoever of the controversy surrounding the Keystone XL pipeline. Odd that you do a show about climate, but you don't mention that. So again, within the constraints of the obvious constraints of corporate media, it wasn't that bad, but again, it wasn't the greatest thing I've ever seen either.
Well, let me play the Pollyanna, right? If you're not a climate activist, if you're someone who just happened to be, got done watching the baseball game and ended up with Ann Curry on TV on a Sunday evening, did you come away better educated or less better educated, shall we say, or less having a less accurate perspective on the issue?
I think on the whole, because of the expertise of Jennifer Francis and Jason Box, you would have come away with more more wisdom on the issue. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, it was on the whole good, but it could have been so much better if we had heard the voices of say somebody like a Senator Sheldon Whitehouse or Bill McKibben or Michael Bruin or people who are in the arena trying to get political action done to sort of ramp down emissions and sort of have the United States, you know, show global leadership on global warming, as I like to say, it would have been a much stronger program. If it was a documentary movie on a 4-star scale, I'd rate it 3.5 out of 4 stars, but it's one of these things where you want to see a 4-star effort and a 4-star product every time out.
Well, I tell you, I think we're on a bit of a media, this will be our media review show, because the other thing that came on this week was a program called The Year of Living Dangerously, right? And that was only on web stuff?
Yes, it will be televised. The first episode of Years of Living Dangerously will be televised on Showtime on Sunday, April the 13th, but the first episode was broadcast online on YouTube on April the 7th, sort of as a teaser of the whole thing, basically. It's gotten rave reviews, except from the usual denialist sites, almost unanimously strong reviews. It was an amazing thing to watch. You had Harrison Ford going into Indonesia to report on the consequences of carbon pollution. You had Tom Friedman talking about the nexus between climate change and international conflict, especially in Syria. And then probably the most compelling segment of the show, Don Cheadle spoke to Catherine Hayo, who's a climate scientist and evangelical Christian who lives in Texas, and basically discussing her efforts to try to encourage people in Texas to, you know, recognize the reality of human-caused climate change and the rejection of human causation of climate change among certain residents of Texas. Towards the end of the segment, Don Cheadle argued that perhaps if there were more voices like Catherine Hayo, perhaps the political and religious divide over climate change would be mitigated. I found it to be quite naive, and I think that it sort of undersells and ignores the dynamics that drive climate change denial, but on the whole, it was an excellent segment. And if the other segments are every bit as good as that, this will be remembered as one of the greatest documentary series of all time, I think.
Well, how many segments there are in the series?
It is in 9 segments that will be aired every Sunday night, from mid April through mid June.
Really? Wow. And so people, if they want to see it online, they can probably some Showtime or YouTube connection, but then it's going to be on TV. If you have Showtime cable, you'll be able to see it Sunday night, right?
Yes, and my understanding is also that apparently 350.org will be hosting various watch parties across the country for the subsequent episodes. And also it's been reported that I believe Paul Allen, one of the executives at Microsoft, is also planning to distribute the show after all it's been aired in its entirety. So even for those who don't have Showtime, inevitably they will have the opportunity to witness it. And certainly it's something that this is going to be a very, very big event. Now, will it change attitudes? Which it seems to be the hope of the producers, that it will sort of resolve the political differences and the political conflict. I don't know. I happen to be a very cynical person on that score, but nevertheless, it seems to be amazing work from what I've seen.
Well, it's just, I think that it's an interesting question of the whether or not these things represent some kind of a high water mark or turning of the tide or something. Because to see discussion on TV is better than not having anything on TV, so that's good.
Basically make this point, though, and it is something that did come up when this show was announced, when The Years of Living Dangerously was announced. And you have to say, how would things have changed in terms of movement on this issue if such programming was on the air 25 years ago in the aftermath of Jim Hansen's address to Congress? You know, if this had been on the air in 1989, showing all the evidence that was there in 1989 or 1990, perhaps perhaps we could have had some more movement on this issue.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that people should know about, if they're interested in this kind of stuff, is that the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is a quite a powerful group, is based here in the Boston area. They have offices around the country, of course, but the Union of Concerned Scientists put out a report where they analyzed TV news coverage for the factual accuracy of the things they said about climate change. Right? Did you? And I mean, I'll let you give the headline, DR.
Yes, they did an analysis that was released this week of the accuracy of cable news coverage of climate science. They found that CNN was the most accurate with, I believe the finding was that 92% of MSNBC was the most accurate, that 92% of MSNBC's coverage was accurate on the science. The Fox channel's accuracy was 28%, and CNN's accuracy was 70%, but there was a significant amount of misleading coverage. And basically, the Union of Concerned Scientists made the point that, you know, one of the issues with CNN is that they have this sort of obsession and fetish for false balance, basically, to have, you know, whenever they do segments on climate change, they'll have one climate scientist or climate journalist or climate activist offset by somebody who's connected with a think tank that's funded by the fossil fuel industry, and they are just obsessed with that. Fox News is the Fox Channel's lack of accuracy, shall we say, to put it politely, is notorious. And as for MSNBC, the interesting thing with MSNBC is that as you may know, there's a controversy going on now about their morning show host, Joe Scarborough, Joe Scarborough's rather vocal defense of the notorious climate change denier, David Koch. And a lot of critics of MSNBC have pointed out that, you know, how interesting it is and how odd it is that for a station that purports to be pursuing an audience of one political persuasion, they have on a host who is on 3 hours every morning of another persuasion, and a guy who, even though works for a network that is very accurate in terms of the science, is now waving the flag for a guy who's notorious for being anti-science. So that's always kind of odd.
I think the report was actually it's an easy read. It's only 10 or 12 pages, and I think the points you made, DR, are good. I mean, what the report does is to pull up into, I don't know, 20-point font some of the advice they have. And to your point about the false balance on CNN, what they say is that if CNN had not hosted any debates about climate science, its accuracy would have increased by 16 points to 86%. So much of the inaccuracy that's put out that goes through CNN is in these sort of debates where you get one kookaburra guy who's going to say whatever he needs to say to keep the paycheck coming from the oil company. Mm-hmm. So, and then I won't even go to the Fox thing because it's very hard to be wrong 75% of the time unless you're trying, right? Mm-hmm. And the MSNBC folks, they say, you know, the criticism of them was that they were sometimes too extreme in trying to promote the climate issue. So their 8% of errors typically came from overstating things. And they said, just, you know, make sure you get your facts straight. But it's an interesting read, and it's back to the whole question of, you know, are we slowly moving to some better balance on climate discussion on TV?
Well, the other interesting thing, and I'm surprised this hasn't gotten a lot of attention, is that, you know, they mentioned CNN, Fox News Channel, and MSNBC, but I wonder what their analysis is of the accuracy of Al Jazeera America, because Al Jazeera America has gotten a lot of praise for its climate coverage. And just looking at what's offered online, they seem to be doing a very, very comprehensive analysis in recent weeks about, you know, backlash against drilling in the Everglades, the controversy over fracking, the controversy over the Keystone XL pipeline, the droughts, the severe droughts on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. So I do wish they factored in Al Jazeera America in terms of the accuracy of its coverage.
Right. I think to the UCS's Union of Concerned Scientists defense, they probably were looking at segments that happened before Al Jazeera gained any prominence. But I agree with you. Al Jazeera does a great job. And again, I'm not plugging for Al Jazeera, but it is an interesting sort of interesting news segment that you are not going to see on any other, on MSNBC, on CNN, or on Fox. Al Jazeera has them, and a lot of it is good climate stuff. So that's a good point. But, Gary, we were talking before about CNN and the coverage of climate science, and we got onto the topic of the Malaysian airline, the sad topic of the airplane that crashed. And the coverage, the over-the-top coverage that CNN gave to that.
Exactly. And how interesting it is that they seem to be focusing on, you know, planes that go down, but they don't seem to be focusing so much on emissions that go up. And recently, in a media appearance, Bill Maher, the comedian who is famous for HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher and formerly of ABC, he basically made the point that, you know, CNN should be doing a better job of covering all the pollution that is taking place on our oceans, and that's something that is rarely, if ever, talked about on CNN. He basically made the point that one of the reasons why issues such as pollution are not covered is essentially that there is a fear that you know, certain interests will be alienated, certain interests will be ticked off if you start covering issues of pollution. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, when you look at what has been done to our oceans, the acidification of our oceans, the fact that so many oceans are filled with oil and plastic and garbage that's just done.
Well, I mean, I think to your point, it's they would just nonchalantly say that, oh yeah, they couldn't really tell if it was a floating airliner because, or it could be just some piece of garbage that's floating out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and without remarking at how astounding it should be that all this junk should be floating around in the millions of square miles of open ocean out there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it is an interesting one of these points where you look and say, oh yeah, that, why aren't they talking about that?
And Maher also made the point, and it's been made, a point that's been made by the investigative journalist Brad Friedman, that years ago, news was considered prestige. It was not considered to be, it was not supposed to be a moneymaker. You weren't supposed to monetize the news. The news was supposed to represent the class of the network. But now we're living in an age where news is about, you know, making money and grabbing eyeballs, and that naturally shoves certain issues and certain concerns off the table, because after all, you know, why talk about carbon emissions when you can talk about Justin Bieber, basically?
Oh man! Well, since we're on the media path tonight, the other thing I wanted to point out to folks that are listening is an article in Grist's blog, which is basically talking about science fiction books, and the piece begins that within science fiction, the idea of a future time where all of society has collapsed and some brave people have to rebuild and figure out how to live their lives in a destroyed place. I mean, that's an old trope in science fiction. But that there's a new class of stories coming out that they deemed cli-fi instead of sci-fi, but it's climate fiction. So the dystopian end of the world stories and how people deal with the impact of climate change. I mean, did you see that one, Dion?
Yes. It's a very interesting topic about, you know, how science fiction writers are addressing things that too much of our media won't. You're seeing some great fiction about the consequences of carbon pollution, and just basically, you know, fiction about the societal breakdown that occurs when pollution is running rampant. And I can't help noting that you know, it's an example of everything old being new again, because, you know, there was the precursor to cli-fi There was the great writer John Bruner, is a British author, who wrote about themes of, you know, society collapsing as a result of environmental degradation. And one of his most famous books is known as The Sheep Look Up, which is about, you know, the sort of chaos that results when you just have, you know, unchecked and rampant fouling of the air and the water. So it's nice that this new generation of cli-fi books is continuing that great tradition. Sometimes, truth, you can get truth out of fiction that you cannot get out of a news, sadly.
Well, I tell you, I mean, what struck me about the piece in Gris is that they made reference to an author. I don't have his name in front of me. I think it was Paolo Balducci or something. It was a funny name. And that author wrote a short story in a book that Bill McKibben edited that came out maybe a year ago. And I'll put up a link to the website. But long story short, in the short story, this guy had written something called the tamarisk rind, referring to some sort of a plant, and now he's written a novel. But that short story, the tamarisk rind, was for me one of the most clear-cut pictures of what it would be like to be living in a climate change world. And in particular, it was in the southwest where the black helicopters were flying back and forth over the covered little Colorado River that were trying to bring what little water was left to Los Angeles, and how the internal parts of the West had been basically dried out. And this, the hero of the story, was trying to keep his family alive when the police, when all the police cared about was making sure that all water possible would go to Los Angeles. And that's a credible future, right? And it's dystopian, but it's not fantastic, if you know what I mean, a subtle distinction. It was saying, you read it and say, oh man, that really could be the way things are. I was reading a book called Rivers, which was set on the south, basically the Louisiana coast. And the idea in the book was that basically there's a continuous hurricane going on, and this guy is trying to live a life. I guess the question is whether or not, as I said before, if the Godzilla monster was a symbol of the atomic bomb destroying Tokyo all through the 1950s, right? Mm-hmm. Are these stories sort of the underlying, the nightmare that people have in the back of their head about climate change, and that the stories bring that into something palpable and real?
Well, you mentioned the Godzilla movies. I can't help mentioning another issue of the visual depiction of what happens when things go chaotic, which is the famous television movie The Day After, which was aired, I think, 31 years ago now, showing what would happen in the aftermath of nuclear war. And and you get the sense that that these books may accomplish for the public that movie The Day After. The Day After has been credited with essentially inducing Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to sort of get cracking on finally bringing a resolution to the Cold War. So perhaps if something can you mentioned that author Bagyogupi, I believe, Paolo Bagyogupi. He writes a lot of science fiction novels for young adults. Well, maybe we can get some young adult movies on this theme about the twilight, if you will, of humanity, if we don't clean up our
act. And I am not a movie critic, so if you look at, you can interpret even The Hunger Games as kind of a post-apocalyptic kind of story, right? Mm-hmm. And that's aimed, now, I've got a review somewhere that says the new movie called Noah with, who's the gladiator
Russell Crowe,
right? That's supposed to be visually fantastic and has a fairly clear kind of global warming connection, or at least they say you walk out of the movie with that sense. I haven't seen the movie yet, so I don't know. And then, of course, there's a report saying that our favorite climate hero, Mr. Al Gore, is contemplating a sequel to his famous movie, which would be interesting, huh?
Yeah, definitely. Although I can make an argument that there should have been a sequel several years earlier, and perhaps there should have been a series of these movies along the lines of Any other documentary series where every few years they go back. I think of the famous sequel to I think it was called Pets or Meat, the Michael Moore sequel to Roger and Me, which showed what had happened in the couple of years after Roger, mm-hmm. after the events of Roger and Me, and maybe we should have had Inconvenient Truth in 2009 and 2012. Better late than never, but still, it would have been nice to have some sequels to that great movie earlier.
I think that. Mr. Gore being vice president, almost president, senator, and Nobel Prize winner, and an Academy Award guy, if he wants to take a couple years off, I'll give him a pass on that.
Right.
All right. So look, let's get on the plane in Hollywood and fly back to Cambridge, where something more serious happened this week. The president of Harvard University, I think her name is Drew Faust, right? She sent out a letter to the faculty, or an open letter, talking about Harvard's approach to investing in fossil fuels, right?
Yes, this was a reported, I believe, first by Brad Johnson of Hill Heat, who noted that Harvard President Drew Faust has announced that their endowment will now commit to sustainable investment practices, that Harvard will become the first educational institution to sign on to the United Nations Principles for Responsible Investment. And this was seen as basically some sort of attempt to sort of blow off the negative heat that Drew Faust had generated as a result of, essentially saying, hell no, I won't divest. And in fact, a number of Harvard faculty, nearly 100 Harvard faculty, have registered their sort of objection to what Drew Faust tried to do. And earlier this week, it was reported
because it didn't go far enough, right? She has said that Harvard will have this virtuous policy in terms of its endowment, right? It's going to have green principles, but she didn't say she was going to divest, and that's why the faculty's giving her heat, right?
Yes, and 93 at least, there's some reports saying it's much higher, 98 to 100, have signed an open letter to the university basically saying that, this is all nice and good, but Harvard must absolutely divest. Half measures won't cut it. Saying that you're going to invest in more environmentally sustainable investments won't cut it. You absolutely have a moral obligation to once and for all divest from fossil fuels. It will be interesting to see if Drew Faust does respond to this demand, or does she continue to make a Faustian bargain, so to speak. I'm surprised no one else has come up with that pun.
I knew you would come up with it. Well, I tell you, you see the thing that Exxon put out last week in response to the shareholder action. This is basically an in your face. We don't think we don't think the world's going to address climate change, so we're not worried. I think that divestment becomes almost the only choice.
Exactly.
Well, I think we've consumed enough of our listeners' time this week. I want to tell them and tell you that you can check out the links to most of what we've talked about here on the blog. We'll put it up at massclimateaction.wordpress.com. Please leave a comment, or you can send us an email to comment@massclimateaction.net. Of course, when you're on the website, please contribute to MCAN. You can find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/massclimateaction. Please share our show so that your friends can learn about us. You can listen to this directly on your smartphone using Stitcher. You can find us on iTunes. And if you just search for Mass Climate Action under the podcast headings, you'll get it. You'll find us. You can subscribe there. Please do. It improves our visibility and helps other people find the show. You can follow us on Twitter at Mass Climate. And DR, you tweet it at DR Tucker, right?
That is correct.
And one word, and as I always say, DR has a continuing stream of interesting facts on Twitter. So let me close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much, DR, for being with us tonight.
Sure.
And thanks to everyone for listening. Goodbye, and we'll talk to you next week.
thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.